The law of social validation. Face it, as a persuader, people are going to believe other people more than they believe you because you have something to gain. You know, when we're unsure how to act or the situation is unclear, not sure what to do, most people look to see what other people are doing. That is how we're programmed. We tend to change our perceptions, our opinions, our behaviors in ways that are consistent with the group. We tend to act like other people, even though we don't like to admit to. It's all about social validation. We look to norms. When we go into a situation, we're not sure what to do, we look to see what other people are doing. I remember flying into the island of Maui in the afternoon. It tends to be very windy. Plane was bumping and a rolling and a swinging side to side, and was kind of a interesting, scary landing. And everyone looks to the flight attendant, and when the plane dropped, hit some turbulence, and the flight attendant screamed and turned white, that made us all a little bit nervous. We look to them to be the expert. We look to them to know if things are going right or wrong. What is the art of social pressure? We are social animals. We have an innate desire to belong to the social group. It is precisely because we value the sense of belonging so highly that the more other people find an idea, trend, or position appealing or correct, the more correct that idea becomes in our own mind. The law of social validation recognizes and builds upon our innate desire to be part of the main group, to do what other people do. It also recognizes that we tend to change our perceptions, opinions, and behaviors in ways that are consistent with group norms. Even if we don't admit it, or maybe even realize it, we care about what others think. We use others' behavior as a guide in establishing the standard for choices and decisions we make. I was in Taiwan doing some speaking and training, and they took us out to dinner afterwards, and here comes a big plate of snails. Now, I'm all about trying new things. That doesn't bother me, but I didn't know how to eat them. How do you eat a plate of snails? They put it in the middle, so I did what most people do. I sat back to watch because I wasn't sure if you just pop the whole thing in your mouth and crunch the shell or suck it out and throw the shell away. But as I watched, people put the snails on their plates. They picked them up. They popped out the inside of the snail with a toothpick and ate it, discarding the shell. And we do this with every aspect of our life, especially when we're unsure how to act. We seek to find out what others are doing in a way of validating our own reaction. This method is how we decide what constitutes correct behavior. We see the behavior as more correct when we see others doing it. The more people do it, the more correct it becomes. Professor Kirk Hansen, he was at the Stanford Business School. What he did on the internet is he boosted downloads for best-selling files on the web by downloading those files over and over and over himself, so the counter was officially high. So, many times on the internet, we look to see what is the number one download. So artificially, he took some of the worst ones and made them number one. So they observed these boosted downloaded files, and they started becoming downloaded even more frequently, that they stayed high on the list. The high number on the counter indicated popularity, and people were most interested in downloading the files that were already ranked the highest. If it's good for somebody else, it's good for me, even though they don't know the person. Whether the question is what to do with an empty can of soda at the park, or how fast to drive in the city, or how to eat the soup at a restaurant, the validation of others gives us our answer and guides our actions. We feel validation when we see others do what we want to do. We learned early in life that we make fewer mistakes if we follow the social norm. And there's two types of norms, explicit and implicit. Now, explicit norms are openly spoken or written. For example, road signs, employee manuals, or game rules are all examples of explicit norms. Now, implicit norms are what we're talking about. They're not usually stated openly. For example, you don't need to be directed to say hello or smile when you see someone, but you do it anyway. Somehow you know better than to put your feet up on the dinner table when you're a guest in someone's home, even though your host most likely will not request that you refrain from doing so. If we don't know the norm, we look around to find it. The law of social validation becomes a way to save time and energy in figuring out what is correct. We use others' behavior to guide our own actions, to validate what we should or should not do. We don't always have to look at the positive and the negative in every situation. This automatic trigger saves us from thinking. We compare what we do against the standard of what everyone else is doing. If we find a discrepancy between what we observe and what we do, we tend to make changes in the direction of the social norm. Some have even called this social judo. This social validation compels us to change our behaviors, our attitudes, and our actions. Often this happens even if the things we observe don't really match our true feelings, style, and thoughts. We go against our better judgment because we want to be liked, accepted, and found in agreement with everyone else. When we are part of the crowd, we no longer feel individually responsible for our emotions or actions. We can allow ourselves to shout, sing, cry, or strike without temperament imposed by personal accountability. We seek out social norms to help us know what we should be feeling or doing. For the most part, this is not a conscious process. We subconsciously accept many ways of behaving that are determined by our surroundings and the actions of others. Let me give you an example. Raising our hands to speak in class, tipping in a restaurant, how we behave at a concert. When we become part of a group, our once divergent emotions tend to converge. Understand, usually as long as the majority of people agree with what we are doing or about to do, we feel social validation. For the most part, we're all conformists. We will do what the crowd does. We don't like to admit it, but it's true. Only 5 to 10% of the population engages in behavior contrary to the social norm. We see this law operating in groups and organizations and meetings and in day-to-day public life. In all of these circumstances, there is a certain standard norm. In churches, the moral code determines the standard behavior acceptable for the group. In organizations, the bylaws and years of tradition establish a standard operating procedure. Because we want to fit into these groups and maintain our membership with them, we conform our actions to their norm or to their standard. In fact, when we find ourselves in a foreign situation where we feel awkward or unsure how to act, like we talked about, we look for social cues that will dictate our behavior. This could be at a party, during orientation, a family gathering. When the social information we are seeking is at all ambiguous, we don't know how to respond, we continue seeking out social clues. Imagine if you were sitting in a movie theater, enjoying the movie, eating your popcorn, drinking your drink, and somebody shouted fire. Do you think everyone would jump and run for it? Well, if everyone else did, you would too. If everyone remained seated, you would probably remain seated also. The law of social validation is in action all the time and everywhere. Publicly passing the donation plate to help with the community project. Doing the wave at sporting events. Going to a popular dance club when you don't enjoy the surroundings. Being afraid to raise your hand in class to ask a question. Franchise owners having their athletes sign contracts in public. Stacking the top 10 most popular books right in the entry of a bookstore. The way we choose restaurants, maybe the ones with the longest lines. The way we choose movies. Washing our hands in a public restroom only when somebody else is watching. And restaurants seating their patrons near the window for everyone else to see. Why? You've walked into an empty restaurant before, nobody there, you're the only one, you're the first one. That's kind of an unnerving feeling. That's why when people do decide to stay, they sit them where people can see them, either outside or when they first come in. Sometimes theaters even employ professional audience members to start laughter, clapping, and even standing ovations. When audience members see others stand and cheer or applaud, they were more inclined to do so. This happened to me in New York City, going to a play on Broadway. I spent all this money, but this play had won all these awards, so it must be good. Social validation. So I'm sitting there. I didn't get it, didn't like it. I was looking around. I'd lost interest. And towards the end of this play, I saw people walking down the aisles and taking seats. And when the play was over, they all stood up and started clapping. They gave it a standing ovation. These people caused the standing ovation. And what was I doing? I noticed I was standing and clapping with everybody else, and I hated the play. That is social validation. Performers commonly salt the tip jar by placing some money in there themselves. When people see the money in the jar, they think others have already made contributions, and they assume this is the appropriate and acceptable thing to do. Salting the tip jar is done by pianists, bartenders, bus drivers, even the homeless on the street. Even churches practice salting the collection plate. People are more inclined to donate if they are passed a plate that already holds some bills. Even in Vegas, people don't like to play cards alone. Many people don't want to be the only one there. So they actually employ fake players to sit down, which will trigger more people to stop and play. Even researchers from Arizona State University reported that Billy Graham's organization had coached thousands of volunteers on when to come to the front, when to sing, when to clap, and it showed great religious intensity. That's social validation. People manning the phones were even instructed to pretend they were talking to people when the camera came their way so it appeared as though they were getting a huge volume of calls. This would give social validation to the at-home audience that this charity was popular and an acceptable organization to donate money. Imagine, you're watching a special, they're donating money, please give, please give. And if nobody was on the phone, nobody else was giving, why would you give? Or video and DVD rental stores. How do they increase their profit? The older movies are the most profitable, but people want to rent the new movies. And they notice a lot of people would come and look at the return bins to see what other people had rented. Because if somebody else rented it, it must be good. So they would take some of the older movies, mix them in with the returns on the newer movies, and people would pick it up and say, wow, look, huh, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. Wow, that must be a good movie. Somebody else watched it, and it increased their profit. They put the older movies in the return bin. Social validation increased the rentals of the older movies significantly. What about the old MCI's Friends and Family campaign? They gained 10 million customers in less than 10 years. If we believe friends and family are doing it, then we feel social proof and family pressure from those people whom we know so well that it must be a good company or product. That's why referrals are some of your best prospects. Referrals are your greatest source of social validation. Etiquette is also a form of social validation. When we eat, what we order, what we drink, where we put our napkins, how we cross our silverware when we're finished, all forms of social validation. Have you ever noticed how no one wants to be the first to order dessert? But once one person does it, everybody else does. But if that one person doesn't do it, usually nobody does. If the majority does not want dessert, most of the time, no one will. I recently attended a business opportunity seminar that was promoting a home-based business for $4,000. And it was a great deal. Throughout the course of the event, I saw many elements of social validation. The organizers used testimonials from people who were successful. The testifier stood up and claimed that his business opportunity was the answer to his economic woes. Then, as a form of social validation, all those who were ready to sign up had to walk to the back of the room. The first few people ran to the back sign-up table. This was proof enough of the soundness of the business idea, and the storm of people followed suit to sign up. Of course, once at the back, there was a gentleman with a credit card machine running everyone's credit card, tempting everyone's ear with that familiar sound of credit card machines crunch. What happens when you go into a Saturn dealership? You see pictures of all the happy customers. What about infomercials? You'll see somebody from, I better not say a state here, a certain state, you can use your imagination, that has no teeth, they're not dressed very well, and you're watching the infomercial, let's say it might be real estate or something else, and they say, I made $10,000 in my first 2 weeks, and they kept going on how they became a millionaire, and you're thinking, well, wait a minute, if they can do it, I can do it. Even gangs exhibit a powerful manifestation of social validation. New initiates allow older members to beat them up just so they will be able to belong. Fraternity hazings also reduce the initiate to a subhuman level, all because of the overwhelming desire to belong to the group. One fraternity hazing forced new members to drink so much alcohol that one guy passed out. Members, oblivious to the seriousness of the situation, thought he was asleep and left him there to sleep it off. Unfortunately, it turned out he was found dead the next day, in the same spot they had left him the night before. CNN reported about Marines who were initiated into the military with an initiation ritual called blood pinning, where the recruits' badges were literally pinned into their chests. Psychologists have identified people belonging to these organizations with what is now called gang syndrome. Gang syndrome manifests itself when a participant feels shame for the crimes they've committed, but they went through with them anyway so they could finally have a sense of belonging or a sense of family, typically a feeling they've never experienced in their own home lives. I once attended a college football game between two fierce crosstown rivals. Emotions were high, and we all wanted our home team to win. One of the fans near me was using a megaphone to taunt the other team and its fans. And it was meant in good fun, and I was laughing, everyone around me. But it wasn't too long before a rent-a-cop came to the man and told him he could not use the megaphone during the game, and to hand it over. The rent-a-cop stood in the middle of the aisle of this sold-out game. The fan said he was just having fun, but the rent-a-cop stressed, it was strictly forbidding. It was against the rules. Then the social pressure and validation kicked in. The other fans nearby told the rent-a-cop that the fans' overzealous actions were okay. There's not a problem. Don't worry about it. The rent-a-cop tried to persist, but the crowd only grew louder in their protest. Finally, the rent-a-cop decided it wasn't worth the hassle and left. Even watching somebody else do what is right will give your cause social validation. For example, one study asked 10,000 high school students to give blood. This study found that those students who were exposed to 38 photos of other high school blood drives were 17% more likely to donate blood than the students who did not see the photos. Seeing others do the right thing prompts us to socially validate the cause and jump on board. That's why we always teach persuaders to have a relevant story available. Other people that were in the same situations, other people that were maybe going bankrupt, just like they were, because it has such power in social validation. Because people think in terms of stories. Because when you talk about a happy client that was in the same position, they went through it and they were very happy with the purchase, or even a story of someone who walked away and look what happened. We see that in insurance and in life insurance. Someone was going to think about it and they were involved in a car accident on the way home from the insurance agency. What about Candid Camera? They do a lot with social validation. If you ever watched Candid Camera, they did one called Face the Rear. It's interesting to watch people's behavior when they get on an elevator. They tend not to talk. They're equidistant from each other. They look up. Men probably more than women. But the person got on the elevator, and there's three people facing the rear of the elevator. Of course, they got on, hit the button, looked around, and they faced the rear also. And that's true with books. Just turning it over, flipping it over, see who's endorsed the book is enough for the person to buy that. When Oprah says, read this book, that's enough social validation for people to go out and make it a bestseller. You have to understand the power of the group. In one study, researchers had very young children who were terrified of dogs, scared to death. And what they did is they watched a little boy play with his dog for 20 minutes a day. After 4 days, 67% of the children were willing to sit in a playpen with a dog and even remain with it when everyone else left the room. The results were lasting too. 1 month later, the same children were just as eager to play with dogs. In a similar study, children who were afraid of dogs were influenced just the same by films of a child playing with dogs as they were watching a live child play with the dog. In another study, a group of participants were asked to identify the longer of two lines. Now, these lines were displayed on a screen. Now, one line was clearly longer than the other, but many people in that room were instructed, privately of course, prior to the study to state that the shorter line was the longest. The surprising results were that several of the unsuspecting participants actually gave in to the social pressure and changed their answers. Over the course of the entire study, 75% of the participants gave the incorrect answer at least one time. In a related study by Ash, it was determined that even when the correct answer is obvious, individuals will knowingly give the incorrect answer over 37% of the time just to go along with the consensus, just to be part of the group, just to follow the social norm. You know how often you hear that canned laughter on sitcoms, even when there isn't anything really funny happening? Studies prove that using canned laughter actually influences audience members to laugh longer, more frequently, and give the material higher ratings for its funniness. Even for the portions of the show that seem to have no humor at all, producers use laugh tracks to get us to laugh along. The sad part is it actually works. There is evidence that canned laughter is most effective when the joke is really bad. When two audiences watch the same show, one hears a laugh track, while the other doesn't, it's always the audience who hears a laugh track that laughs the most. Another study was set up to see if those walking on a sidewalk would stare in the same direction and look up if there was another group of people already doing so. So researchers arranged groups of 1 to 15 people to congregate in New York City on 33rd and 42nd Street. A video camera was set up on the 6th floor to catch the results on tape. Sure enough, the more people in the group who were already gawking and looking into the air, the more people walking by stopped, came over, and stared and looked up themselves. We see this with lines. So people see a line, they get in. I was in an airport in San Francisco. Lady got up behind me, started talking, conversation. It was great. We started to board, and she wanted to know if it was the flight to Denver. I said, no, it's not. And she just got up and walked away. She saw a line, and she got in it. Sometimes that's a knee-jerk reaction or a subconscious trigger. Another one is when participants were asked to view a political debate among George Bush, Bill Clinton, and Ross Perot. And it was found the mere presence of a Confederate who cheered for one of the candidates influenced the participants' overall evaluation of that candidate in a positive manner. We know with politics, it's usually by sections of the country. Each section of the country believes in different things and picks different candidates. All usually social validation. Obviously, when receiving information in a social setting, the audience can be skewed to perceive the information the way the group tends to hear it. In another study, researchers wanted to see if mothers who had just given birth to their first child would be more likely to adhere to the guidelines for their new baby's nutrition when instructed individually or in a group. So they had new babies. Would they listen more alone or in a group? The mothers were told that it could be important to give their new babies cod liver oil and orange juice. I don't know what they're thinking, but that's what they said. The mothers were either taught one by a nutritionist associated with the hospital or in groups of six. This is what the study found. When taught in a group setting, the mothers were far more inclined to give their babies cod liver oil and orange juice than those who had been taught individually. Now, you have to understand the dark side of social validation. We call it bystander apathy. Numerous studies demonstrate that when someone is in trouble or in need of help, as the number of bystanders increases, the number of people who actually help decreases. Bystander apathy. Now, what this is, bystander apathy occurs because in almost any situation, the more people that are present, the more we feel a diffusion of responsibility. Our sense of social pressure is lessened when we feel that there might be any number of people more capable of helping than we are. That's why in many accidents, no one calls 911 because we think everyone else or somebody else has called 911. Have you ever been in a situation where because of the numbers in your group, you really didn't give it your all? Let me give you an example. Be truthful with yourself. Maybe an academic group project, you noticed you weren't working as diligent as you would have been being solely responsible for the assignment. Or maybe you helped push a stalled car to safety with some other people and you realized you really didn't push your hardest. When we find ourselves in groups, there is, without a doubt, a diffusion of responsibility. Sometimes we don't know if we should even involve ourselves in the first place, since there are so many people who could take action. Have you ever seen someone pulled over on the side of the road, but you just kept driving along with all the other cars speeding by? When there are large numbers of people involved, we tend to assume someone else will respond and take action first, or we might conclude that our help is not needed. Catherine Genovese. She was a young woman living in New York City, and she was murdered one night when she was coming home from work. Now, the unfortunate truth of the matter was that in a city like New York, her death was just another of countless murders. So, consequently, the incident didn't receive any more coverage than a few short lines in the New York Times. Her story would have remained obscure if it had not been for one small incident. See, a week later, A.M. Rosenthal, he was the editor of the New York Times, went to lunch with the city police commissioner. Rosenthal asked the commissioner about another homicide in the area, but the commissioner, mistakenly thinking he was asking about the Genovese case, revealed a shocking piece of information that had been uncovered by the police. You see, Genovese's death had not been a silent, hidden, or secretive occurrence. Rather, it had been loud, drawn out, and a public event, as her attacker chased her down and stabbed her three separate times in a 35-minute period. 38 neighbors watched from their apartment windows and didn't even call the police. Rosenthal promptly assigned a team to investigate the incidents of bystander apathy. Soon following, the Times came with a lengthy front-page article detailing the incident and alleged reactions of the neighbors. This is what the article said. For more than a half an hour, 38 respectable, law-abiding citizens in Queens watched a killer stalk and stab a woman in three separate attacks in Kew Gardens. Twice the sound of their voices and sudden glow of their bedroom lights interrupted him and frightened him off. Each time he returned, sought her out and stabbed her again. Not one person telephoned the police during the assault. One witness called after the woman was already dead. Wow. Now, everyone was completely stunned and baffled. How could people just stand by, witness such a scene, and do absolutely nothing? Even the very neighbors alluded to in the article, they didn't know how to explain their inaction. Responses included, well, I don't know, I was afraid, I didn't want to get involved. But these didn't answer anything. Why couldn't one of them just make a quick call, an anonymous call to the police? Different branches of the media, newspapers, TV stations, magazines, and radios, pursued their own studies and investigations to explain this incredible scenario. All of them basically arrived at the same conclusion, that the witnesses didn't care. They concluded that there was just no other explanation. Now, let's back up a little bit. Do you really think 38 people, did not care enough to make an anonymous phone call? Did the researchers not understand the diffusion of responsibility? The neighbors did not react thinking someone else would help or someone else would call the police. Deep down, most of us are good people. It's only 1 out of 10,000 that's dishonest or a bad person. Now, I don't know, I'm making that up, but it sounds good. But most people are good people. If each individual neighbor knew it was up to them to phone the police and get help, I guarantee they would have made the call. Another experiment conducted in New York highlighted this tendency for bystander apathy. It determined that when a lone individual observed smoke leaking under a door, 75% of those studied reported the smoke. So they had somebody in a room, smoke's coming under the door. When they are by themselves, 75% went for help. Now, when they were in groups of three, that dropped to 38%. They'd plant two people, they wouldn't go, and the third person would look around, nobody else is doing anything, so they don't need to do anything. And in the group, if the two other people encouraged the third person to do nothing, it dropped to another 10%. Often the problem is that we don't know if we're really witnessing an emergency or not. For example, we see someone collapsed on the floor. We might waver between two conclusions: heart attack, are they drinking too much? Other bystanders may appear to be apathetic more, they're uncertain. And if they are uncertain, they often don't help because they don't know if they're responsible to do so. Everybody else observing this event is likely to be looking for social evidence too. Because most people prefer to appear poised and level-headed when in the presence of others, they are likely to search for evidence with brief glances at those around them. Therefore, everyone sees everyone else looking unflustered and failing to act. When people clearly know their responsibilities and recognize an obvious emergency, they are amazingly quick to respond. Then there's another aspect called de-individuation. Fessinger, Peptone, and Newcomb coined this term way back in 1952. And it's even more alive today. See, de-individuation refers to when we find ourselves in a group, we become less self-aware and less concerned with how others will evaluate us. Think of all the people you've heard yell obscenities at sporting events. Do you think they would do that if they were in a small, intimate group watching the same event? Basically, de-individuation means that when in a group, we feel more anonymous and therefore less individually responsible for our actions, often causing us to say things that we would not normally feel comfortable with. For example, in Seattle, one of the main bridges going into Seattle, it's time to go to work, it's rush hour, bridge is shut down, there is a suicide jumper. People are mad, they are stuck. De-individuation sets in, and people start yelling out their windows, "Jump, get it over with, we're late for work." Can you imagine that? That would never happen one-on-one. And the sad thing is, she dumped. The good news is she survived. The power of de-individuation. A study was conducted during Halloween to show how de-individuation can lead to antisocial behavior. So on Halloween, researchers evaluated over 1,300 trick-or-treaters, either alone, one-on-one, or in groups. Now, each one of these groups had a chance to steal candy from 27 Seattle homes. The researchers figured that Halloween would be a perfect occasion to conduct a study because the children would be in costume, making them more anonymous. So the children would come to the doors, they were greeted by the experimenters, and they were told they could choose one piece of candy. In some cases, the experimenter asked the children their names, while in other cases, the children were allowed to remain anonymous. Then the experimenter would leave the room as though they had to go to get something. Unseen observers took careful note on how the children responded. When they were alone, 7.5% took more than one piece of candy. When they were in groups, over 20% took more than one piece of candy. It was also interesting to observe that the children who remained anonymous stole more candy than did the children who gave out their names. De-individuation prompted many of the trick-or-treaters to go against what was socially accepted and steal more candy. You see, anytime we find ourselves part of a group, we feel more susceptible to peer pressure, to the opinions of others in the group. The more esteem we feel for the group, the more their opinions matter to us, and therefore the more we feel pressured to align our own opinions with those of the group. Even if we don't really agree with the group, we often go along with them, so we are rewarded instead of punished, or liked instead of scorned. In a way, this is an obvious observation. Anyone who has ever been to the movies knows that the size of the crowd in the theater has a big effect on how good the movie seems. The larger the crowd, the funnier the comedies are. Consider these examples. We tend to conform when you believe everyone else is correct. We tend to conform when you fear the social rejection of not going along. We tend to conform because it's the norm. And we also tend to conform because of cultural influences. Social validation is a critical thing to understand as a persuader. And how do you use this in marketing? Marketing professor Max Sutherland explained, "The more a brand is advertised, the more popular and familiar it is perceived to be. We as consumers somehow infer that something is popular simply because it is advertised. When people are buying gifts for others, social proof is one of the most effective tactics that a sales clerk can use." See, many salespeople find out great success in telling their clients that a particular product is their best-selling or most popular on hand because such a technique increases the social validation of the product in the mind of the buyer. When customers feel like something is more popular, they spend more money to acquire it, even if there's no proof other than the salesperson's word. Even in a restaurant, what is your best seller? What is the most popular? Is enough to choose a meal to eat. And the same thing's true with advertising. simply asserting that a product is in super high demand or that it's the most popular or fastest selling is always proof enough. When consumers think a product is popular, that's often all they need to go out and buy it. Even in a simple thing like toothpaste, the commercial shows you how much you should put on there. That, on television, shows social validation on how much toothpaste you should use. The creation and use of social validation is rampant. Clubs make their spots look like the place to be by allowing huge waiting lines to congregate outside their facilities, even when the place is practically empty inside. Salespeople often recount the many other people who have purchased the item in question. Sales and motivational consultant Cavett Roberts said it best when he stated, "Since 95% of the people are imitators and only 5% are initiators, people are persuaded more by the actions of others than any proof we can offer." So let's make this work. The power of social validation can be used to your benefit in any persuasive situation. If your product or service is socially validated, people are most likely to use it or switch over to it. People are always looking around and comparing themselves to see if they line up with everyone else. If they feel a discrepancy between where they are and where everyone else is, they will most likely conform to the group standard. So three things to consider. The larger the group, the more people will conform. Social theory shows us that when a group grows, so does the conformity to that group. The greater familiarity, the better. The more a person can identify with the group, the more that person will be influenced to change their behavior or opinions. Social validation is more powerful when we observe people we consider to be just like us. And think about this. The clearer the principle of social validation, the better. Find the best use of social validation in your product or service. Is it the best selling, the most popular, used by the elite, the fastest growing? Is it a part of a trend or is it the industry standard? Who uses it? Do you have testimonials from other clients or users? You can never have too many testimonials. That is social validation. People will love to give social validation. People love to give testimonials. The more people say that your product or service is the right thing, it helped them, other people are using it, you create social validation, and it increases your ability to persuade. Use social validation in every aspect of persuasion, and it will change your ability to persuade.